You're listening to Intellectual Erection,
a place where we talk about the naughty.
To stimulate your thinking.
You're listening
to
Intellectual Erection.
Intellectual Erection.
Передачу, где мы говорим о диспуте, там субъект
секса.
To stimulate your thinking.
Welcome back to another episode of Intellectual Erection. I'm your host, Patrick, and today I'm talking with professional dominatrix, Lady Delphine.
Baby bird feeding somebody a mush banana and then spitting it on their junk and getting them to like jerk off with mushy banana as lubricant is pretty entertaining. Even more so when you're sitting on their face and suffocating them.
We discuss a paper that she wrote for her master's on sex work and the intersections of therapy and professional BDSM, as well as emotional labor. And then we get into some other topics around the paper, around some of the legalities of BDSM and issues of sex work, race play, and we end off on some pretty kinky stories. So as always, listen, like, review, and most of all, enjoy. I'm sitting here today with
Lady Delphine.
Hi, Lady Delphine.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. Why don't you let the audience know what it is that you do?
Well, I am a professional dominatrix here in Toronto, also an academic, which I believe is why you dragged me here kicking and screaming in the cold weather to come and talk.
I'm glad you braved the cold to be here.
Actually, it's not that bad today.
All right. Well, professional dominatrix.
Yes.
Academic. And beautifully, we have an intersection of the two today because you wrote a research paper on being a dominatrix.
Absolutely.
So your research review paper title is The Labor of Pleasure and Pain, Exploring Intimacy and the Therapeutic Aspect of Professional BDSM Through Emotional Labor. It's a lot of things to chew through over there.
Well, academics like semicolons and long titles. So.
Yeah, they do. They really fucking love that. Okay, so before we get into any aspects of your paper, the first thing that I always ask all of my guests is the origin story.
Okay.
So it's a two-parter. First part, you don't have to answer, is what I always say, but everybody ends up answering anyway, so it's good. I've been lucky. The first part is a deep dive into your past.
Okay.
And then the second one is kind of how you got involved into where you are now. So the first part goes like this. Do you remember the first time as a kid where you encountered sex or sexuality? And what that experience was like. Maybe you didn't know anything about it then. Like, what was the first time that it became apparent that you can remember?
I don't know if it's the first time, but the first thing that pops into my head was probably the first time I went to Las Vegas, which I think I was in like grade 2 or 3. So whatever age that is.
Grade 2 or 3. You must be like 9.
9? Yeah. And it was just everywhere. Like, it was sequins and breasts and bodies and people making out in bars, and everything felt right, and I don't know why it did. Everything was just sexually charged in a really positive way, and I subsequently went back many, many times before I was even 21. So I think that was a good stepping stone. Played a lot of playground games of torturing, you know, prisoners and taking people captive on the playground. So I'm guessing that has some form of correlation, but.
So you started doming early.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah.
I was one of the only girls in my neighborhood, so it was all young boys that just had to follow along with whatever games I was doing.
So you naturally got into the dom role because you were just the only one around.
Yes, and I'm an only child, so you make up games however you can, right?
All right. So
I suppose.
There you go. So then how did you end up where you are today? You're a professional dom today.
Yes.
And an academic. At what point did you get involved in the sex-positive communities, and kind of why did that happen?
As I was graduating high school, I kind of had an inkling that something sex-positive, sex work industry was in my future. I didn't really know for sure. As you probably read, you got to see this whole answer, but When I moved to Toronto, I got put in contact with a travel agency that kind of did this escorty companion dynamic with their travel. So I would go to Jamaica and provide companionship to couples there at Hedo and got a taste for it.
What is this travel agency? Are you allowed to say?
Probably not.
No? Okay, well, apparently there's a travel agency out there that provides,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so then I did that for a couple years. I was kinky in my personal life, so when that kind of came to a natural end, I thought, well, I kind of can't give up what I enjoy doing, but how can I do it differently? So I put the two and two together and interviewed with a pro dom in the city and started working. It's been about 3 years now.
3 years in the same spot?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Do you work with Lady Pim as well? Or is that...
I haven't worked with her, no.
Oh, okay. No. So different spots.
Different spots, but there I do know there's somebody very excited to see us both, so that might be happening in the near future.
Okay. Well, you heard it here first. You got Lady Pim, who's been on the show before, and Lady Delphine together. I've also had Lady Henry on here. So
she's a firecracker.
Oh, if you heard the story, yeah, that's saying the least. So one cool thing that I picked up in your paper is something that I think should have been intuitive, because I realize why it's the case. I always heard colloquially, and I've always pronounced it this way, the plural of dominatrix is dominatrixes.
Yes.
But that's not the case. It's dominatrices, like when you have a matrix and matrices. And that's when I realized, I'm like, duh, why it's the case. So, if anybody needed to hear that, because I sure did, it's dominatrices.
It is. And I've had many people try and correct me, and then I had to, like, do the whole Google thing of, like, well, this is actually how it is. And they're like, that didn't, like, click in their brains for most.
Yeah, because people, I guess, are just not used to it.
And not many people say dominatrix, plural, anyways. I know a dominatrix. It's not like we're a murder of crows or something that we're normally referred to as, but yeah,
you usually don't come in a gang.
Typically not.
Depends if you can afford it.
gangs are fun.
Gang bangs are even more fun.
Yes.
Soft yes,
very much yes.
Okay, so here we go. I'm going to talk about your paper, so I have a few questions here.
Okay.
After reading your paper, you give a brief history of the term sex worker and why it's important for solidarity and destigmatization. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, it's a relatively new term. If I remember, I said 1979 is when it officially was coined.
I think so, yeah.
Look at me remembering more than I thought.
There you go.
But yeah, it was a huge step for advocacy of being able to be a collective. I was bringing together, you know, both indoor and outside workers and presenting a unified front. I think just in the same way that we use acronyms for, like, the LGBT community, is that it's not singling out one person, and these rights are across the board. We all want the same things. The reason I included it in my paper is because I know that pro-doms, depending on who you talk to, may or may not identify with that term, and I kind of wanted to stir the pot and ask why. Is it because of the services that they provide, the positionality of the provider, or more of a social reason? So that was kind of the logic behind including in trying to make the history pronounced, was for unification and my personal stance too of identifying as a sex worker.
Yeah, because I think the message, it's important to get out there, the message that if you want destigmatization, the best way to do that is not by trying to distinguish yourself from other sex workers if you're in the field. So if you're a stripper, if you're a full service sex worker, if you're a masseuse, if you are a pro dom, I don't know if I'm forgetting.
Phone sex operator.
All sorts of people that basically provide a service that's somehow sexual in nature is probably a sex worker.
And
having that form of solidarity helps out for the people that are really marginalized in the community, like the full service sex workers who have no legal protections.
Yes.
Because I've encountered some people too. I remember having a conversation with a stripper on Instagram, and she asked to come on the show. And I said, that's great. I've had a lot of sex workers on here. She's like, well, I'm not a sex worker. And I didn't answer. And she's like, yeah, the girls, there are girls in my club who do that and ruin it for everybody.
Yeah, and I bring that up in my paper, too, of them wanting to maybe use the term exotic dancer because it separates slightly in that way. And even when I first started doing pro-dom work, there was some people I encountered who were very definitive of this is not a sexual service. And I wanted to question and challenge that, but, you know, it was more of a cut-and-dry answer of, I don't do full service, not sex work, end of conversation.
Right. It's fine to distinguish, I think, if you're going to do or not do any sort of full service sex
right.
service.
Yes.
But to kind of distinguish yourself and create that hierarchy mm-hmm. that was cited, that was said in your paper. And, yes. and like anybody who's a sex worker knows the term probably hierarchy is where, yeah, you have, you know, the distinguished at the top and then the fully marginalized at the bottom. So when she said that to me, like that girls at the club that do that ruin it for everybody, I'm like, okay, I know that you're not the type of person I kind of want to interview on the show.
Right.
Because, yeah, you are definitely up for holding that that hierarchy.
But I've even seen that distinguished too in pro-dom communities, not so much in Toronto, but when traveling and having conversations of, you know, other dominants distinguishing if they've given a hand job versus the other person and being like, well, she did this or she's done this. And there is this internal like battle and hierarchy even sometimes within communities. Because there's a broad definition. And if that isn't upheld, people find their morals challenged throughout that.
Yeah. Just employing shame.
Yes.
I don't think is a good practice for trying to have solidarity within a community that's clearly diverse and
absolutely
experiences all forms of shame and guilt from the outside already. Okay. On to the next question. In the section on scene setting, you cite yes. three types of pro-doms. One is the pain-producing dominant.
Yes.
The other is the non-pain-producing dominant. And the third category is fetishistic. So I'm just wondering, for, you know, clarification, what do each provide and how do they differ or overlap and where do you identify?
Okay, that's a multifaceted question. Honestly, I don't know if I could name anybody that really fits one of those categories completely. Of course, there's a lot of us that do identify more as being sadistic or caring or sensual, but those are so individualistic, especially A, from the provider, and B, from the client's point of view, that I think those three easily mesh together. The reason it was fleshed out in that section was to show diversification, but really I believe most providers, even in wanting to provide a service, meld all three together. So the pain is, I would say, more of the disciplinarian, strict dominatrix that has probably the most stereotypes around the corporal punishment, lack of, you know, I don't want to say lack of compassion, but like that, like removed feeling between client and dominatrix, whereas the non-pain is a lot more of a sensuality and potentially more of the sexuality that is more overtly shown within a scene. I don't know. I think I initially started branding myself as more strict and sadistic, and that sorely went out the window because as much as I love corporal punishment, I'm such a huge tease and like sweetheart to people that I would say that I'm a mind-fucking category. That's my fourth categorization. Mind-fucking's
a good one.
Mind-fucking.
I could see how coming in, maybe you'd want to start off with a little bit of distance, just being new to the thing and,
right.
you know, not knowing exactly where to start or not having a lot of experience, is probably easier to start with emotional distance and just practice certain activities. And then once you get comfortable, you're like, yeah, come over here, you little bitch.
Yeah. And I think you adapt to with what the clients that you naturally attract. I was noticing that most people that were filling out my booking forms didn't want to be caned and left with bloody marks for days. So it was adapting to that too. You can market yourself and hope for the best, but sometimes the people that you really enjoy engaging with like something that's maybe softer or wicked in a less overt way. I do a lot of needles. I do a lot of sounding, a lot of like CBT, but it's often done while like swapping, like cooking recipes while I'm, you know, hurting them in some capacity.
For those of you that don't know, needle play, you yes. will have needles inserted through your skin.
Yes.
Sounding, you have metal rods going down your urethra, typically into a penis. And CBT is not cognitive behavioral therapy. It's cock and ball torture.
Yes, it is.
Wonderful. Yeah. Okay. So in the next section, you write something that came as a bit of a surprise, actually, to me, reading okay. it. You cite something that says, in North America, a person is not able to consent to an assault that causes significant bodily harm, making any BDSM practice that leaves visible marks a criminal offense, regardless of whether consent was obtained.
Yes.
Now, I don't know how many people are aware of this, or whether or not they consider this to be problematic. I can kind of understand why this law is in place, and I'll give an example.
Okay. Now I'm curious of your curiosity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, initially it took me by surprise. I'm like, oh no, this sucks, because that means you can be culpable after a BDSM session. But if somebody were to come in, if a police officer came in and caught you in the act of BDSM, it would be on the onus of the person receiving the pain and whatever's visible marks to say, no, I don't want to press charges. This Correct. Is consensual.
Yes.
At which point they couldn't do anything. I think that cops can still press charges on their own if they don't believe the person.
Right. I believe that's true too. Yeah. But I think they would ask the client's point of view beforehand, but it also depends what are they walking into, right? Like, I don't know what their personal opinion too of what the cop deems abusive.
Yeah, because I believe there was something about cops being able to press charges on their own without having the person who's being assaulted.
Right, yes.
So I can see why a law like this would be in place to prevent coercion, right?
Correct.
To prevent situations
yeah.
where somebody could be abused. I'm wondering if you think this law needs to be changed, or if it's in place for good reason to prevent abuse. Or what your thoughts are on this?
I mean, changing it, I think, is problematic because it's initially there for reasons that don't have anything to do with BDSM, obviously. People's physical safety and being assaulted. Potentially there could be an amendment or maybe a subsection that does discuss that, but I don't really know how easily sexuality and sexual practices are going to be taken up in legislation, mostly because we already have many fights going on with, you know, rights for sex positive workers or sex workers, that might be potentially in this climate too big to tackle. I don't know of anybody who has been charged of it, so maybe it's not even anything to worry about. I think if you are working potentially in somewhere that's higher risk of being raided or having police visits, then that might affect you. Though I'm not quite sure of the legal workings of how often that even gets prosecuted. I don't have a legal background, unfortunately. That might be a good question to kind of parse out more and see how often have people been convicted for assault for BDSM practices. Is it more of a lifestyle thing has happened? Is it more of a pro-dom situation? Has anyone even really been, you know, accused of assault due to sexual practices in a consensual manner? I think that's the caveat of it, of consensual, but
yeah, I mean, my initial reaction to this was, whoa, like something bad can happen. And then I slowly reeled back and I'm like, wait a second, this law is in place for probably good reasons.
Right.
And you're right. Yeah, you don't often hear of people getting charged for engaging in consensual BDSM. I've heard of cases where people use BDSM coercively.
Correct.
And
yes.
In which cases, then I could see why it's important to uphold something like this for the safety of the people involved, especially people who are subjected to abuse. And what can happen sometimes in BDSM is people can use BDSM as a cover for their abuse.
Yes.
And people can groom, and people can even have somebody under their coercive power presume that they're consenting to what they're receiving. They might be in a situation where they've been groomed to believe that this is okay for them, and they're in something entirely toxic and abusive.
Absolutely, which is why I think it's a huge question to
try. And there's questions of mental health. It was the one thing that came to mind was the thing that happened in Germany, where this guy basically put an ad out and he was looking for somebody to murder and cannibalize.
Right. Yes. Yes. Yes.
And he had somebody who consented, and he had all the evidence for consent, everything that he even had videotapes. And basically, this guy came over, cut off his penis, fed it to him, and then slit his throat and cannibalized parts of his body for the rest of like a couple months until he was discovered. And then when he was put on trial, he was like, I had all the consent to do it, but he still got charged, right? Because it doesn't take into account that person's mental health who consented to something like that. So
absolutely. Yeah, it's a crazy question.
Shit got dark real quick. Okay.
Which is unfortunate. The guy ruined all of our fun cannibal fantasies for years to come.
Oh, no. We just want to eat little bits.
Just little bits. Square inches. Or...
All right. You write a great deal about emotional labor.
I did.
Okay. So there's two things that I want to ask about emotional labor. Okay. The first is how you feel about the idea of emotional labor being appropriated in everyday language to refer to unpaid emotional consideration. So people that are like, you know, I'm doing emotional labor, you see it on the internet, people talk about it. It's become a sort of colloquial reference to any time that somebody has to employ emotional consideration.
Yeah, that came up, I gave a quick presentation of this paper to other providers on the weekend, and we had a really lengthy discussion about this, because a lot of the stuff that we do is compensated. You know, we set our tribute and our rates higher for these reasons, because, you know, we may only spend an hour or two in the dungeon, but we do maybe 4 or 5 hours of other work that is unpaid because we don't have the capital in front of us, but potentially the math works out that we are covered. So I don't know. I use Hochschild's definition and studies of emotional labor because it fit probably the best for how I would talk about sexual labor, insofar as that we are providing a service. Yes, we get paid well for it. Yes, we, you know, if we are choosing this freely, are hopefully enjoying it, but it is strenuous. We do lead quote-unquote double lives. There's a lot of thought process that might go into hiding identity, so there is higher levels of emotional stress. You are, for a temporary time period, being a fantasy. I don't think that is exclusive to workers in our industry, but I think it isn't discussed as much because the conversation normally is, well, they're selling their bodies or they're using their body for labor, and it becomes more of a health discourse conversation than a physical or mental or emotional discourse. And I think that's really what I was trying to raise, is that, yes, we can talk about, you know, HIV and STIs and like physical safety, but like, what about the emotional aspects of it? The pre-planning and the negotiating that does happen outside of the space that we are typically working in, whether that's, you know, an in-call or whatnot. But it being used every day, I mean, I feel like so many words and definitions now are thrown out everywhere. You know, safe space is, you know, anywhere is now talked about that. Or so, as far as I guess my opinion on it being used for everything, hard to say, in the fact that, yeah, I think a lot of people do things that maybe they're now taking into account aren't being compensated, but how far do you extend that? You have to do many things in your daily life that aren't going to be compensated, and it's just daily life.
Yeah.
So is it work-related? Is it labor-related? Is it just emotional or personal relationship-related? I think that's kind of things that need to be taken into account when broadly using this term. But
so what I'm hearing is that you don't necessarily have any issue with people using it colloquially to refer to emotional consideration insofar as they're trying to set boundaries with other human beings and say, listen, what you're asking of me right now is unpaid labor that I'm, even if I'm qualified to do, I don't want to do without compensation, versus people just throwing it around loosely at a point that it dilutes the meaning.
Correct, yes. Yes.
Okay. Because I think some people do use emotional labor language responsibly to kind of say, hey, I have a boundary. I'm not qualified to be your therapist, so I cannot do that for you. Or you're asking something of me that I do professionally to do for you for free. And
right.
In which case, yeah, it could be.
Right. And I think that's where boundaries need to be put in place, and being able to have that conversation is good. I don't know if boundaries and emotional labor are necessarily inexplicably intertwined as definitions, because those are very broad and very, I think, slightly separate in the original creation of them. But yeah, I would agree with you on that.
Right. So I guess it would be clear in an example where somebody would ask something of somebody else that requires a lot of emotional consideration. And after the fact, that person says something like, that was a lot of emotional labor.
Right.
But then is the definition the same as the academic definition, which refers to feeling like you, like this is part of your job? And the obviously the examples with the airline, the flight attendants, that's kind of where this research started, right?
Yes.
So flight attendants are expected to smile, put on a face to serve the clients, to make the clients feel at ease. And that's part of their job, and without which they would probably be unemployed, fired, whatever,
right.
Or they'd be trained, retrained. So in this case, is it fair to make that comparison to something that you have a choice to do in daily life? Because I can also imagine instances where people can be extremely exhausting and make you feel like you are putting on a face for their benefit with no benefit to you, either monetary or personal or emotional, and that they have this expectation of you, right? And they're exhausting your resources for their own benefit.
Yeah, but I think if that's a friendship or something that is outside of a commodified dynamic, then I think that's more of a boundary that you have to then set of, you know, I'm too tired to deal with this today. Can we revisit it tomorrow? Or can I help you get in touch with someone who's better able to manage this? Where I started to make a lot of the connections with the flight attendants and with, I mean, my job is that a few of my friends who are flight attendants say that you get paid from the moment you're on, like, the plane to when the plane lands. But if the plane is delayed for 3 hours and you're sitting in the airport and people are asking you questions, you're not being paid for that, but you still have to answer questions and be considerate and be smiling and be a beacon of positivity, but you don't get paid till you step on that plane.
Right.
It's no different than, you know, I might have received a deposit, we've talked about things, but then they're texting and calling every day for the next 2 weeks till their session. Yes, you put things in line, but you might have to navigate around that a little bit to make sure you don't lose your booking, but you don't have the money in hand yet. So I think that's kind of what I was trying to tie of that. It's a professional thing where you have to make your own definition of how far you're going to stretch yourself, but you are at risk of getting fired or losing a client or whatnot if you don't put in a certain level.
Right. So that can take a toll on you, especially if the amount of emotional labor that your job requires is unspecified, but sort of implicitly expected of you.
Yes.
And if anyone's worked in the restaurant industry, you feel the same fucking thing.
Yeah.
Stand upright. Don't lean on anything. Smile all the goddamn time. Be pleasant to people. And it is exhausting.
Yeah. And that's hopefully comes across my papers that I'm not saying emotional labor is only happening in this my industry.
Of course not.
In any work where your paycheck is dependent on you being happy or you being attentive, you're going to be exhausted because some days that's not how you feel, but you just have to do it.
I wonder if this begs the question if it would be important in the future to set out emotional labor within the contract of a job, as in how much is expected of you insofar as putting in emotional labor.
Yeah, that would be interesting. And that's why we had that conversation of a few DOMs. We're like, well, you do realize that, like, we get paid what we get paid because we have to deal with this. And then there was others who were like, yeah, but I didn't ask for it. And it's juxtaposed of what emotional labor maybe burns you out too, of what level is too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So the second thing that I was going to ask about emotional labor is, I think, something that you might have covered already, which is that pro-doms are often required to perform high levels of emotional labor because their services often don't involve mainstream sex. So this is within the sex worker community. There seems to be a high level of emotional labor required for pro-doms, right? So how does emotional labor feel to you, and what are some of the side effects? And I think you talked a little bit about it with the burnout and whatnot.
Right. I think a lot of the emotional labor, I'll speak mostly on my own end, I won't speak for everyone broadly, is just cultivating an experience that seems seamless. And sometimes that is the hardest part of, you know, maybe never have met this person before. So having to jive with multiple energies and make something flow and feel authentic and feel timeless for that aspect. So I don't experience burnout often. I am very fortunate in the fact that I can take days off. Like, I just went home for a week without much consideration. And I think that's a position that not many people get to have, is I can just book days off when I'm tired. But in session, it's more so of just holding myself to a hyper elevated level. I'm very authentic. I'm very much the same person, but just completely on my best behavior. I'm paying attention to your safety. I'm paying attention to my reactions, to what the space around us is. So I think it's just more of emotional hyper-awareness is my personal labor, of just to keep things flowing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you compared it to being in theater.
Yes.
Right. It's a lot of acting. It's a lot of scene setting. It's a lot of role playing. It's a lot of negotiation also, which is something that you talked about that we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of work that goes into a scene that maybe isn't exactly observed. And I picture it like an audience watching the theater. They see the final product.
Absolutely.
But the final product is just one rehearsal out of so many, and all the production value that goes into it. And I think we underestimate the amount of work that goes into something like that.
I think my best friend actually made the best statement of this, because I really wanted to be an actor. That was kind of the direction I thought I was going, you know, between 17 and 19. And he said, "Delphine, you literally play the greatest game of improv every time you go to work." And it is that, because, you know, we get a booking form. I have a general idea of who this person is. I might have talked to them on the phone. I know what their interests are. Kind of maybe have made a rough game plan for the time we're spending together. But everything is then off the table. Because if they come in and go, "Oh, yeah, I hurt my shoulder last night. Okay, can't do the first hour that I planned. Okay, pick it up. Let's go. Or, you know, halfway through, "Oh, you know, I'm really not feeling this anymore. Okay, cool. Let's try something else." And it keeps you on your toes. It is like playing improv with someone you've never met, who you just have to keep going because the audience is watching and hoping you to perform properly. So,
right. And in this case, if anyone's wondering, the audience is the client, who is there to experience something authentic without hiccups, without too many interruptions. So yeah, you have to be on your feet and work with what you got.
Absolutely.
Okay, the next thing I want to ask.
And have a really good sense of humor.
You do?
I would say that's the other thing, is you have to have a good sense of humor.
Oh, you have to have a sense. Okay.
Like anything in sex, you have to have a good sense of humor.
All right. So the next thing I wanted to ask is, part of your work looks at BDSM under a reflexive and critical lens of a therapeutic service. What does that mean for you, and what are some of the major criticisms that you outline in connecting therapy with pro-doming?
I like how that's like three sections of my paper rolled into one question.
Yep. So if we start from the beginning, you made a sort of reflexive remark in the beginning, saying that yes, BDSM can be treated as therapy, but also I'm not a therapist. I recognize this. I know my limitations, and then you talk about the parallels between therapy and BDSM and how similar things can happen. People can have therapeutic experiences.
Right.
But then comes the issue of people who come up to you and say, well, then why don't you just become a licensed therapist and a pro dom and combine the two? And that's where the criticisms kind of poured out that I thought were very interesting.
Well, that whole section came out of the literature. I wasn't initially going in the direction of therapy, but a lot of the research that has been conducted, that became an unexpected outcome of the people that they talk to. So a lot of the conversation is pro-doms that were interviewed in this 2011 study use the word therapy or therapeutic to describe their work. Whether or not they were using that directly as in they feel like therapists isn't really discussed. So for me, it's all about what the client gets out of it. I do not approach my practice as therapeutic. I think that there is benefits to BDSM and I do see how it has therapeutic value, but I'm there to provide a sensationalized erotic fantasy experience, and if they have some sort of epiphany, I'm more than happy to help walk them through that. But I don't start off going, oh, tell me about your childhood traumas, we're gonna work through those.
Maybe you should.
PhD idea. But most of us, I think maybe there's a handful, aren't trained in therapy. We're aware of the headspaces and the traumas that get linked with BDSM and why people might seek us for that. But I think BDSM and professional dominance are a really great tool to use in conjunction with therapy and vice versa. I don't think one is necessarily going to solve an issue. Your therapist isn't going to flog you and I'm not going to psychoanalyze you. Hopefully not. I'll try not to. So a lot of the critiques are, and what I talk about at the end of the paper, is that people who aren't in the industry are like, well, then just, you know, get licensed. Well, there's a lot of issues with, you know, licensing and being having a credential, because a lot of us are in this industry to not be regulated. And a lot of us do this for non-therapy reasons, and I don't think that's a bad thing. Sometimes, you know, sex is just sex, or BDSM is just BDSM. And it's hard to navigate whether or not you want to use the word therapy, because I think that's a branding issue as well as a detriment to potentially your clients if they have expectations and you're not well equipped to handle those emotions. So I think that answered your question. I have no idea. Yeah. I feel like I've derailed a bit, but
No. You're definitely on the ball. I appreciated those criticisms in the end of the paper. There was some stuff in there about how if you become a licensed therapist along with your pro-doming, then that also further marginalizes other sex workers.
Correct,
because now you're seen as the legitimate ones versus, you know, full service sex workers that are criminalized, that have no governmental protection. And then aside from that, another interesting thing was the idea that if you are doing therapy as a pro-dom, then that can also pathologize BDSM.
Right.
And people's tendencies and fetishes suddenly become abnormal tendencies that are treatable.
Yeah, and I don't think it's anyone's objective is to medicalize.
Because that could further stigmatize it, right? It makes it seem like it's a problem, and that problem needs to be solved.
Yes.
In the dynamic of a therapy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then it doesn't seem to make sense at all to try to make BDSM and pro-doming into therapy. However, like you said, if somebody walks in, has a great time, and mm-hmm. for them it's therapeutic, congratulations.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to keep circling back to this conversation because there was a lot of really good points brought up. Is one of the doms said, well, I go to, you know, my personal trainer and I feel like you know, relieved. It felt like something, a weight off my back. It was a form of therapy, but I would never say my personal trainer is my therapist.
Yeah, you feel the same thing after you masturbate.
Exactly. Right? So
it's self-therapy. That's everyone's favorite form of self-help.
That's a good form. but, right? So I think that if you are equally trained in both and that's what you want to do, that's perfectly fine. But I don't think as an overall industry, it is therapy. I think it can be therapeutic. I think it can be enlightening and freeing, but we're not there to solve world issues.
Well, I think this whole discussion about it being therapeutic at all comes from something very specific, which you addressed in your paper, namely subspace.
Yes.
So in the paper, when you discuss subspace, you cite first the physiological reaction as the activation of the sympathetic nervous system, the release of epinephrine and endorphins, and a subsequent period of nonverbal deep relaxation.
Absolutely.
And then you follow that up with the sort of existential definition that it helps promote an expansion of the client's identity.
Yes.
So maybe you want to talk a little bit about subspace and how you observe some of these experiences or how they were described to you by clients.
Well, when it is discussed in session, and I will have the caveat that it doesn't always happen, which is something that people like to put on booking forms of, I would like to be in deep subspace. And it is not a switch. It is something that is gradually going to happen. And if I have never met you, I will probably not be able to induce it by snapping my fingers. And if I can, then that is great. But yeah, it's, you know, a moment of, a lot of them describe it as a moment of outer body experience. Some say it has similar feelings to being intoxicated or high, and some just feel of a deep fatigue, but not in a like a heavy way, but more of just a like, I would like to take a nap now to regenerate. So it has a pleasant attribute towards it that when we use aftercare, we're trying to slowly coax you back to reality, because some people do get lost in the brain fog and the hormones that are coursing through their body. So it can be euphoric in that capacity. And I don't know if you've experienced subspace. When I have, it is altering.
I don't think I've ever experienced subspace because I'm not a fan of subbing. Personally,
I mean, nor am I, but
yeah,
there's somebody in this community that has spanked me into subspace. But
really?
We will.
I don't like any sort of corporal punishment. I just don't like bottoming in most, if not all, circumstances. I prefer the top.
Yes.
It's my comfort zone. But I will tell you, after a good romp, I can feel that bodily heaviness, deep breathing.
Yes.
But it's also excited in the same way by my nervous system. And it's my heart rate, my whole body's kind of like sinking and I feel like spaced out.
Right. Yeah.
But also in a very sort of energetic way, which I think might be a little bit different than maybe subspace. I see subspace as a little bit more mellow. Mine's a little bit more of a high.
Okay, yeah.
So, but I think it's also the sympathetic nervous system reacting in both scenarios.
Correct,
it's all fight or flight.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And I've seen different descriptions from people based on what got them there. Some people that enter subspace through sensory deprivation describe it differently than those who went through a really intense corporal scene. But that's also the reaction of different hormones going through your body. If you have a whole spike of adrenaline from, you know, being whipped, it's going to be different than potentially lulled in a nothingness space when your senses are being deprived. So, and I think also the way in which you maybe react to other things like substances are going to give you a different subspace feel.
Yeah. So, I mean, at the end of the day, it's all based on sensations.
Absolutely.
So it's heightening sensations and the experience of those sensations, or the complete removal of that in some instances, like you're talking about sensory depth, where it makes your body react.
Yes.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, then the next thing I wanted to ask you was something you discussed toward the end of the paper, which was race play And you said that it was something that you kind of refused to engage with, despite people having requested it of you. Now, I've talked about this on the show before, so I'm curious to hear your thoughts before I kind of go into mine.
Okay. I'm guessing when you spoke about it on your show before, it was probably with a person of color?
Yes.
Okay. So, since you cannot see me currently, or maybe you can see me,
You're a bit translucent. I'm seeing through you.
Yes. There's not much pigmentation in my skin. I am a floating ghost of red hair. So my experience of race play has mostly come from the fact that my heritage is German. And people have a love for uniforms and military play. And it just so happens I have been asked to be a Nazi. That's an interesting discussion to have. No one normally puts that on a booking form. It's like when they're in the space, it has come up. So
they ask you in person.
It has been. Because, you know, I'll get a request and it'll be, let's do an interrogation. Okay, I can do an interrogation. And then it'll be, do you have, you know, a military costume? No, I don't, but I can kind of create something, and then it'll be in person. I've heard that you can sometimes, you know, speak in German, and, you know, we could maybe integrate that into a scene. Which then has been many sit down conversations of why. My rationale of, you know, I don't feel comfortable enacting that. I'm not one to bring up historical traumas, especially in my own life, because I have a whole perspective of how I grew up, and that doesn't align with my sexuality, and I don't think it aligns for many people. But yeah, it's an interesting conversation in terms of where boundaries and where limits are, and what race play looks like, and what the meaning behind it is. Because I've heard many examples of, you know, providers of color wanting to kind of flip the script and, you know, have their white client enact a plantation scene, and that works for some people, but I can't personally rationalize with that sort of role play.
Right. I mean, I've heard sort of explanations for race play in the most consensual terms possible.
Yes.
How it, just like every other form of BDSM or fetish, it taps into a deep taboo and it tries to renegotiate that relationship and sort of take the power back.
Yes.
From those nasty taboos and play with it. And in that play, we do some sort of work. I don't know. But my issue with this, with race play,
mm-hmm.
is that the potential for harm is extremely high.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You could be engaging in deep trauma that you're not aware of. And maybe even the person requesting it is not sure why they're asking that sort of for that sort of play.
Right.
And furthermore, when you have a dominant and a marginalized group, to empower somebody from the dominant group and disempower a person from the marginalized group in a power play scenario has very few consequences for the person in the dominant position.
Absolutely.
And it has a lot of consequences, potential consequences for the person in the marginalized position. So my point there is, I don't know if you can still maintain a sense of agency in...
And I think that's the question, right?
That scene, yeah.
And even more so in a dynamic where you may not see this person again, there's only so much you can do in terms of consent and aftercare and ongoing care if they've only booked you for an hour and that it's the last time you're going to see them. I've heard many people that I'm friends with say that they've done it in their personal life with their, you know, partners in whatever capacity. But, you know, if you wake up next to the next person, there's a lot easier to check in and renegotiate and parse out those historical traumas versus, you know.
Yeah. I mean, in personal relationships, I see different issues because
yes.
if you have somebody who's excited to play the dominant role in, mm-hmm. in race play, particularly like if you are a white person who's excited to participate in race play, I would question why. And then there's a fact that you can't get at, which is the intent. So as much as you establish a relationship of trust and consent, you can never tap into the mind of that person to
know,
you know.
Which is why it is a huge, like, hard limit for me.
Yeah. And I mean, the person that I had on the show here, it was called Luther on Race Play, the episode. He talks about it as being a bull. He's a black man in the sex positive communities, and having been invited by couples to for him to have sex with a woman, and it's usually white couples. And for him, it was not a matter of consensual race play. It was in the midst of having sex that N bombs are dropped on him.
Right. And
it's scarring. It's shitty, and it's a horrible experience to have when you're so vulnerable in the midst of having sex with somebody. So there's that. I've seen some academic stuff also on race play, but yeah, not comfortable with it.
And writing about race play in academia is very interesting too. I have another paper that I've had to rework many times, because even as a well-informed academic, it's a very difficult topic to write about.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
We got through your paper. So now the last thing I want to ask you is what I usually ask at the end of the show, mm-hmm. is if you have any fun, wild, outrageous, sexy stories that you want to share.
I did recently have a very enthusiastic scent play person who wanted to have feces smell in their nostrils but not actually see the product. So that was an interesting negotiation, but I don't think that's my story. I do a lot of splashing. I do a lot of playing with food, so I think that's interesting and intriguing.
Okay.
I bake a lot. So, and I don't do a lot of golden, but I will do golden in baking. So I make like buttercream frosting with urine.
Buttercream frosting with urine.
Yes.
Okay.
And then you just tie someone to a tarp and force feed them cakes, like very like Marie Antoinette style of. But I think the fun part of that is mush bananas, of like baby bird feeding somebody a mush banana and then spitting it on their junk and getting them to like jerk off with mushy banana as lubricant is pretty entertaining. Even more so when you're sitting on their face and suffocating them. I think that's my story. I think that would be it, of just the sheer amount of food I have made someone ingest just to jerk off.
Wow.
Yes.
That sounds fun. This is your time to shout out all the places where people can find you, if they want to book with you, if they want to follow you on social media, whatever you want to share.
Alrighty. Well, due to Instagram shutting me down, everything, all my tags and labels and @ are all different now. So
let's hear them.
Easiest way to find me is my website, ladydelphinebelrose.com. I am on Instagram at ladydelphineto and ladydelphineb on Twitter.
All right. Lady Delphine, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. You're listening to Intellectual Erection, a place where we talk about the naughty to stimulate your thinking.